is it that we're all going to explore for the next 2 days. The program is really impressive. So it is a great honor for me to be here and to participate in the opening of this amazing event. In thinking about the conference, I try to recall the very first time I ever heard about Sangha Tirthi. As far as I can tell, it was a rather brief but memorable moment some 15 years ago when I was a student at LMU, newly enrolled in the classes at the Institute of Jewish History and Culture. I had always been interested in Jewish history, and particularly the post-war period that usually, growing up in Germany, you never get to talk about in history classes because you don't get past the Second World War. So I started attending these classes, and I surely did learn a lot. I was particularly surprised to find out that shortly after the end of the Second World War, more than a quarter of a million Jews passed through the four Allied zones of occupation. For a variety of reasons, these non-German individuals had fled or had been driven or deported from their countries of origin during or as a result of the war, and were therefore categorized as displaced persons, or as you will often hear, the DPs. A large number of these Jewish DPs refused or had been unable to return to their home countries after the end of World War II, and hence lived for a variety of length of time within the boundaries of the Allied zones, where they waited for the permission necessary to leave for a new home. Following the liberation, the Western Allied forces took these DPs into their care and improvised shelter wherever it could be found. Accommodation primarily included former military barracks, but also summer camps for children, airports, hotels, castles, hospitals, private homes, and at times even religious institutions. One of these temporary homes allocated to Jewish survivors was the Catholic monastery of the missionary Benedictine Santo Tirian, where DP hospital and camp existed, as we heard a number of times already, between 1945 and 1948. At the time when reflecting upon these unique Jewish refugee spaces that emerged during the post-war years, it struck me that in the midst of ruins and destruction, surviving Jews sought to find places that felt secure, whether in their former homelands or under Allied protection. After this first introduction to the topic, I continued to explore the Jewish post-war experience. Most notably, I became more and more familiar and learned to appreciate the complexities of the multiple and entangled refugee crises that shaped Europe's path from the interwar period through the early Cold War. In many ways, Europe's history during the first half of the 20th century was one of refugees. The First World War caused enormous population displacement across the fronts, while the consequences of revolutions and imperial collapse following 1917 generated waves of migration that reshaped European populations and international law. In the 1930s, the rise of ultranationalist movements, particularly Nazism, and the Spanish Civil War created new vectors of displacement. Altogether, the Second World War left more than 30 million people homeless or away from their places of residence, with many undergoing multiple experiences of flight and exile. German efforts to create a racial utopia focused on the radical reordering of populations and the extermination and the exterminatory campaigns of the Holocaust lay at the dark heart of this broad experience of dispossession. In the wake of 3 decades of conflict, successive efforts to sort out the refugee problem helped to create the modern field of humanitarian work. This period of overlapping experiences of flight and resettlement did not really end until at least the middle of the 1950s, when the Cold War froze large-scale movements from east to west and created incentives for states to seek durable accommodation for those who had left their homes during the previous 2 decades. Starting in the 1980s and following the collapse of communism, The topic of migration has witnessed an explosion of scholarly attention. Today, we have access to a wide range of scholarly research about the experiences of distinct refugee groups, the traumas of exile and displacement, and the myriad questions of homecoming that refugees and displaced populations encounter. This literature has been particularly rich with regard to the Jewish experience. More than a few of you who are here today contributed in one way or another to the advancement of this field. The opening of the International Tracing Service archives in 2007 and the availability of tens of thousands of digitalized survivor testimonies in collections all over the world have opened new methodological approaches to the study of war's victims. By any means, this is a moment of extraordinary activity and potential for refugee history. In this respect, the point in time and the subject of this conference, Santa Tilde, the Benedictine Monastery, and its Jewish history, could not have been better chosen. To this day, comparatively little is known about the 3-year history of the Jewish presence at the Catholic monastery. What we do know, though, is that in the shattered spaces of post-war Europe, displaced groups and individuals lived side by side with each other, with civilians in established communities, and with military personnel from the Allied nations as they transitioned from conquerors to occupiers. I'm convinced that the key to writing refugee history is to try to understand this complex and shifting context in which the refugee story took place, a context whose central feature was the post-war experience of devastation, defeat, and instability that reigned across much of Europe. Aiming to pointing the way towards a more inclusive refugee history that looks at the many different kind of refugees and dislocated people in the same context, I decided to center my presentation today on two different groups and their interpretation of the post-war realities that can guide us in tracing Santa Tilde's history following the Second World War. First, as a point of departure, I will portray the experience of Jewish Holocaust survivors during their stay at the Jewish DP hospital and will elaborate on the role of occupation authorities and international organizations in enabling and organizing the Jewish presence at Santa Tilde, before then secondly discussing the monks' perspective on what was happening in their home, taking into account the radical changes in the monastery status under Nazi rule. Ultimately, by bringing these distinct post-war narratives together, I hope to demonstrate that after the end of the war, uprooted populations became sites of contestation, compromise, and confrontation, where numerous groups, including local communities, uprooted populations, international organizations, and occupation authorities, created a network of entanglement mirroring the complexities of shifting post-war settlements. So turning to the post-war realities, or more specifically, the Jewish experience. There's no disputing the fact that Jewish Holocaust survivors living in a Catholic monastery after the elimination of Nazi tyranny is, to say the least, not typical. Why did this group of starved, frightened, suspicious, stupefied individuals end up in this particular place? When did they arrive and how long did they stay? Who was it that decided that Santa Tilde should be turned into a DP hospital in 1945? And how can we imagine the daily interactions of Jews and Gentiles in this hospital setting? As was mentioned before, I think at least twice, the 3-year history of the Jewish presence in Santa Tilde began in late April of 1945. As US armed forces approached Kaufering during the very last month of the war, the SS began evacuating the camps located in that area, sending the prisoners on death marches in the direction of the concentration camp Dachau. We know through detailed reports of those who survived, among them Dr. Zalman Greenberg, the 33-year-old physician from Kovnu in Lithuania and former prisoner at Dachau, that as part of the evacuation, some 3,500 mostly Jewish prisoners who were too weak and sick to walk were loaded onto a train to be sent off to a killing site. The train barely made it to the nearby village of Schwabhausen by Landsberg, for those of you who are familiar with the other Schwabhausen. So we're talking about the Schwabhausen here, very close to St. Ottilien, where this train was strafed by US fighter planes whose pilots wrongfully assumed they were bombing a German military transport train. With orders of the American liberators, the injured survivors of that attack were brought to the German military hospital at St. Ottilien, where about 1,000 German soldiers were being treated at the time. More former concentration camp prisoners in desperate need for medical attention arrived shortly thereafter. Hungarian native Eva Langley-Danos, who had been captured with some other women and deported to Germany by the Nazis, for instance, remembered that a few days after her liberation at the Dachau concentration camp on the 29th of April in 1945, she, and here I quote from her memoir, was transferred to a former German military hospital which the Allies had designated for the special care of ex-prisoners from nearby camps. And she continues to explain with the following words. Reserve Lazaret St. Ottilien, the auxiliary military hospital, had been established in the building formerly occupied by the Benedictinian monks seminary and vacated on Hitler's orders. On the order of the Americans, the same German army doctors, helped by the dedicated Benedictine sisters, now looked after camp survivors. Weighing about 4 stones, which she translates to about 56 pounds, with all muscles, including those of the heart, almost wasted away, my days were mostly spent resting in bed, with drips, injections, pills, and plain food, delivering massive doses of carbohydrates, proteins, and vitamins, building blocks of a new life. In an attempt to reconstruct St. Ottilien's Jewish history, personal narratives like these are particularly valuable as they allow us to get an idea about the situation of the newly liberated slaves of the Third Reich, including their health and disposition, as well as the setup and organization of the hospital. Lange's descriptions are supported by other contemporary accounts, some of them available here in St. Ottilien's archive. For about 3 months, until the summer of 1945, the DP hospital and a hospital of the German army, which was one of more than 3,000 medical facilities established for German military personnel during World War II, existed side by side. The fact that the first Jewish survivors who arrived at St. Ottilien were housed in the gym before the seminary was cleared for them on the 3rd of May in 1945 is a very good illustration of how crowded this place must have been at the time. Among the 2,100 individuals housed here in May of 45 were the aforementioned 1,000 wounded German soldiers, and according to Greenberg, 420 former Jewish concentration camp inmates that were cared for by German hospital staff that included 29 doctors, 128 medically trained staff members, 96 nuns, 54 Red Cross nurses, 75 kitchen staff, and over time, also an increasing number of Jewish caregivers. Despite this unique arrangement in which the German Wehrmacht's uniforms that kept peeping out from under the white coat of the doctor in charge were just one of many aspects that reminded the Jewish patients day after day of the horrors of the last month, many survivors reported very positively about both the treatment and care they received, as well as the peaceful atmosphere that they found in the monastery-turned hospital. The fact that the survivors gathered in St. Ottilien quickly set up the institutional structures that were needed for everyday life certainly contributed to the growing reputation of this place among Jews, mainly in the American zone of occupation, but also beyond that. The quality of the medical specialists working there, the establishment of the aforementioned orchestra that became famous and performed at the DP camps throughout the American zone, the publishing of a newspaper, and the printing of a survivor's Talmud are just a few aspects to be highlighted. In addition, Jewish DPs had access to a prayer room, a kindergarten, and a yeshiva, a kosher kitchen, athletic and chess clubs, a library and theater, and occupational training courses, while also maintaining their own cemetery, the DP police that controlled all entrances to the monastery, and political parties, which all helped them to create a space where they felt safe. Altogether, some 5,000 Jewish survivors passed through the DP hospital in St. Ottilien, and more than 400 babies were born before it closed its door, officially registered on the 12th of May in 1948. One of the single highest numbers of Jews in the camp and the Landsberg area was reported during the time of the 1st through the 21st of December 1945, a few months after all German soldiers had been discharged or moved, and the DP hospital had expanded its operation into the freed up spaces, namely the Winterschule and Ottilienheim. According to the December counting, 8,694 foreigners lived in the district of Landsberg, among them 6,005 Jews living in the camp of Landsberg, and 900 Jews living in the hospital of St. Ottilien. The number of unaccompanied minors at St. Ottilien was estimated to be 176 at that time. 103 of them were boys, and 73 were girls. The report also noted that, and here I quote, the immigration of foreigners, chiefly Jews, was during the last month extraordinarily big, while emigration of refugees and evacuees were seldom. This observation seems to foreshadow the dramatic increase of the Jewish population in the American zone of occupation in 1947 due to anti-Semitic events in post-war Eastern Europe. Tens of thousands of arriving Jewish refugees, also referred to as infiltrees, poured into the existing camps and brought the busy centers to the limits of their capacity. Despite this influx, numbers in St. Ottilien's DP hospital stabilized around 700 in 1946. The year maternity ward was added to the hospital, and occupancy rate went further down during the following year. Any attempt to interpret existing statistical data regarding the occupancy of St. Ottilien's DP hospital is complicated by the high fluctuation of patients and the fact that the Jewish DPs that spent time in St. Ottilien did not register with local authorities, as the hospital was run since October 1945 by the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration, also known as UNRWA, and later on, from July 1st in 1947, it was placed under control of the International Refugee Organization. Regardless of this difficulty, reports from local authorities suggest that Jews living in St. Ottilien benefited, among other things, from the support provided by international aid workers, the presence of rabbis in the area, and the overall large Jewish presence in the area on top of that. The latter resulted, for example, in the municipality of Landsberg providing downtown spaces for the Jewish DPs in 1947 so they could gather and meet on a regular basis for services. However, at a time of extreme housing shortage, not least due to the arrival of close to 40,000 ethnic German refugees and evacuees in the district during the early post-war month, this decision was met with strong rejection by the local population and sparked a number of anti-Semitic incidents in the area. In order to provide as complete a picture as possible of the complex history of post-war displacement, we need to remind ourselves that the confrontation with exclusion and imprisonment, the experience of flight and liberation, and the search for a safe haven remain individual experiences. The aforementioned Zalman Grinberg, who after his arrival at St. Ottilien became the chief physician of the DP hospital and was elected president of the regional Jewish DP's interest representation, the Central Committee of Liberated Jews in the American Zone, he stressed the importance of this particular aspect very prominently when addressing the Jewish survivors that had gathered in the hospital of St. Ottilien for the performance of a liberation concert on the 27th of May, 1945. It was the survivors' task, he claimed in his famous speech, to act as delegates with millions of victims and to proclaim all over the world, here quote, what a triumphant record of crime and murder has been achieved by the nation of Hegel and Kant, Schiller and Goethe, Beethoven and Schopenhauer, end of quote. To make the dimension of this chapter of human experience tangible and comprehensible, Weinberg then used his personal experience to raise awareness for what the Jews went through, what they saw, and why they were still under the relentless pressure of the experience of the last few years. As a matter of fact, it was not uncommon that memoirs of the horrors and hardships returned to the survivors during the month and years after liberation, for example, in form of nightmares. During the early post-war years, when confronted with the extraordinary challenge of regaining a hold of health and life following liberation, the community of survivors at St. Ottilien turned into a much-needed support group, or as Auschwitz survivor and DP hospital patient Ben Lesser described it once, when I regained consciousness after a period of 3 months in a coma, I was in a comfortable hospital bed in a beautiful Bavarian monastery called St. Ottilien. The monks had dedicated one wing for the purpose of medical care and rehabilitation for Holocaust survivors. For the newly liberated, our time together at St. Ottilien was very therapeutic, medically and emotionally. For the first time in years, instead of being tortured and murdered, we were being taken care of. End of all. The scholars, we should not make the mistake to misunderstand appreciation for the medical aid provided by German doctors, as expressed at the end of this quoted passage, as signs of restored confidence in all Germans. Rather, this interaction between Jewish survivors and German former Nazi personnel should serve as a reminder that the contemporary understanding of specific uprooted groups has to be grounded in the broader history of the post-war period. My remarks up to this point have focused largely on the Jewish experience and highlight that in the immediate post-war years, daily life in St. Ottilien was shaped by the presence of Jewish DPs and the rhythm of daily life at the DP hospital and camp. Unlike a number of testimonies and memoirs of Jewish Holocaust survivors suggest, the monks did not initiate or appreciate this arrangement at the time. So let's take a closer look at what role the Benedictine monks played in all of this. How did they respond to the Jewish presence in the monastery? And how did it affect their daily lives and their moving forward after the end of World War II? Since the day the first Jewish Holocaust survivors arrived at St. Ottilien in late April 1945, the Benedictine monks watched them settle in their home, where the community of Jews lived according to the philosophy, what was used by the Wehrmacht belongs now to us. Since the German Army Hospital had occupied nearly every available space at St. Ottilien during the war, this meant that by October 1945, when the UNRWA began to manage the DP hospital, it took the place of the former Army Hospital and thus comprised the seminary, the agricultural school, the Haus St. Gabriel, the inn, the guest house, 2 one-family houses, and the so-called Prokura. And not even the proper monastery had been entirely left to the monks. One floor was occupied by the German hospital staff. In midst of the monastery was an operation theater, while a dispensary, the x-ray station, and different storage rooms existed on the ground floor. For the monks, this was unacceptable, especially since more and more clergymen who returned from forced labor and military service assignments urgently needed housing. Over time, of course, DPs and monks interacted with each other in various ways, some of them very fondly remembered by survivors that found support in conversations with them. Tensions also were part of these day-to-day interactions, though. One particular issue centered on the question of who would be allowed access to the DP controlled space. The DPs had set up their own police. And so if anyone wanted to come to a service, they would have to pass them. And if not, a certificate was issued to give you permission. The DPs initially did not allow anyone else to enter that they did not know. Another difficult facet of sharing the same space was how to allocate resources. To give you two examples of the day-to-day interaction here. At one point, children from the DP camp were caught stealing apples from a tree that was standing on the side of the garden serviced by the monks. The heated exchange of letters, most of this conversation is actually documented in letters, which gives us some idea of how well they communicated. This exchange of letters and a few meetings followed to discuss the right form of punishment and to ensure such incidents would not happen again. Another time, the monks decided to place a lock overnight on the shed from where the Jewish DPs retrieved their coal. Well, you can probably all imagine the response this elicited on the other side. Initially, I was surprised to find when researching for this presentation that the monks, despite their knowledge about the horrendous suffering of the Jews under Nazi rule, produced legal claims for the evacuation of their monastical property from the moment the DP hospital came into existence. Why were they so determined to reclaim their property? And this whole situation, of course, begs another question. Why had the monastery's property been requisitioned for the purpose of establishing a hospital in the first place when it was a well-known fact that church property was not to be occupied by the occupation forces according to existing post-war regulations? To find an answer to these questions, we have to go a little further back in time and look at Zandvoortse's history during the years under Nazi rule. Hidden among thousands and thousands, believe me, thousands and thousands of pages, filled with bureaucratic language and Nazi jargon, we can find important bits and pieces, hints of information that can help explain the rejective stance the monks adopted towards the Jewish DP hospital. And this seems key, towards the Jewish DP hospital and not the Jewish survivors themselves. In 1933, the year Hitler was appointed chancellor, the Benedictine Monastery of St. Ottilien was getting close to celebrating its 50th anniversary. Since its founding in 1884, it had flourished and was able to support circa 300 members of this congregation carrying out missionary work abroad. To sustain this mission, the monks at home maintained an impressive number of on-site facilities, among them a gymnasium for 200 students, a professional school to train up to 40 boys for missionary work, an agricultural school for up to 100 farmers' sons, a model farm with a large herd of cattle, and a printing shop. Following the Nazi takeover, thousands of Catholics, among them clergy, nuns, and lay leaders, were arrested for their political activism, and not even the Reich Konkordat, the legal agreement between the Vatican and the German government signed in July of 1933, could prevent the Nazi persecution of the Catholic Church. Up to date, little has been written about Nazi policy towards monasteries. Consequently, St. Ottilien's chronicle and detailed memoranda composed by the monks are particularly useful sources of information when looking into this chapter of St. Ottilien's history, as they offer detailed insight into the events that unfolded during the Third Reich. Unanimously, the authors of these sources report, for example, that a number of raids were carried out at the monastery, the first already in March of 1933 by the SA. They also recall that in response to critical sermons, a number of members of their community were taken away for questioning by the Gestapo and or imprisoned in Dachau. Relations between the state and the church deteriorated over time, as demonstrated, for example, by the fact that all of the schools that were run at St. Ottilien had to be closed or were forced to close between 1937 and 1938. And the relations reached a new low with the large-scale dissolution of German religious houses, which proved to be one of the most damaging actions launched against the Catholic Church by the Nazi regime. By the summer of 1941, more than 200 German monasteries had been confiscated, St. Ottilien being one of them. On the 17th of April in 1941, the Gestapo arrived and entered the premise to monitor the closing of the monastery. They forced around 70 of the monks to remain on site, where they had to continue to take care of the agricultural work. The others had to leave within a few hours after receiving the requisition notification. The buildings made free by the expulsion of the monks were first used by the Nazi Party and then finally handed over to the Wehrmacht for hospital purposes. Following this transition, 4/5 of the dwelling space and the workhouses were in the hands of the Wehrmacht, the German army. Regarding the living spaces, 1/10 in the highest was allocated to the monks remaining under forced labor conditions. Interestingly, the 17th of April in 1941 did not mark the opening of a military hospital at St. Ottilien, but merely signified an extension of an already existing one. As early as September of 1939, the administration of the monastery and the army site administration of Landsberg had signed a contract without force or other influencing action in which the monastery committed itself to providing two of its buildings, the Ottilien Villa and the Winterschule, for hospital purposes at time of war. In late 1939, the reserve military hospital was already up and running with a capacity of 120 to 180 beds for lightly injured soldiers. This number increased quite significantly to around 600 beds in 1940, was listed at circa 1,000 beds between 1942, after the dissolution of the monastery, and 44, and went up to 1,500 from the middle of 1944 till the end of the war. Chief physician Dr. Philip Arnold from Schwabhausen, who had been in charge of its operations since the hospital's founding in 1939, was entrusted to oversee the expansion of the hospital in 1941, after which also ethnic Germans and prisoners of war were housed in different parts of the confiscated buildings. Why the monks decided to offer up parts of their property as early as 1939 is not entirely clear. One possible explanation for this step could be that the monks hoped to prevent a National Socialist takeover or closing of the monastery, but further research needs to be conducted in order to provide a definite answer to this question. Another consequence of the dissolution of the St. Ottilien Monastery was the plunder and destruction of its possessions. In their studies of the 1941 Klostersturm and storming of the monasteries, scholars like E.D.R. Harrison or historian Annette Mertens document that from the start, the Nazis were driven not just by ideological zeal, but also by greed for the church property. The case of St. Ottilien seems to confirm this observation. Take, for example, the monastery's library, which at the time of the Gestapo's violent takeover consisted of some 50,000 volumes. Following the requisition and dissolution of the monastery, the Gestapo handpicked around 7,000 particularly valuable volumes and took them away before control over the requisition property was transferred to the chief finance president, the Oberfinanzpräsident of Munich, on the 1st of March 1942. After the war, tracing the majority of these volumes proved impossible, which prompted the monks to file a restitution claim amounting to 70,000 Deutsche Mark, at that time even more than it is today, against the successor of the Third Reich, in this case the Land of Bavaria. The negotiations were still ongoing when in 1950, a small fraction of these volumes, 33 to be exact, randomly showed up at the City Library of Munich, which claimed to have received these from the American occupation authorities for safekeeping and did return them to the rightful owner shortly thereafter. Others of these volumes were reported to have been sent to Prague. Don't ask me why, but the boxes that were shipped carried these labels, but it remains impossible to locate them there. A further study of this and other restitution claims filed by the Benedictine monks is still outstanding despite the fact that other studies using this unique archival record have proven incredibly helpful for providing background information on the history of the persecution of different groups of people targeted by the Nazi regime. Against the backdrop of these developments, it suddenly, at least for me, became easier to comprehend why the monks were fighting so hard for the evacuation of the monastery after the end of the war. Finally, in July of 1945, the monastery with all its ancient buildings had been lawfully given back to the rightful owners, the monks, just to be occupied again, this time with a DP hospital. It stands to reason that two different factors could have played a key role in the Americans' decision to requisition Zakatulian on the 1st of May in 1945. This is the official date listed in the release document. Not only was the place crawling with Nazis and German soldiers when the American troops occupied the region, but they also found the hospital to be well-equipped, fully staffed, and therefore fully operational when masses of Jewish concentration camp survivors urgently needed medical treatment. Be that as it may, at this juncture, after years of political persecution and displacement, the monks had obviously reached a point where they were unwilling or unable to adopt the view of Jewish DPs that considered it appropriate that after years of torture, their needs would be served in what had been a German army hospital. Repeatedly, the monks expressed their frustration about the situation that they identified as a continuation of the injustice committed by the Nazis during the Third Reich. In their eyes, placing Jewish Holocaust survivors in the spaces that had been unlawfully taken away in 1941 wrongfully prolonged the state of expropriation that hindered the monks to return to a normal religious life and rebuild their community. According to their view, and here I quote, "We are still suffering by the fact that the monastery was sequestrated. Otherwise, the Wehrmacht, the German army, could not have used so much room. Had we been cooperative with the Nazi government, they would have left the monastery untouched, and surely we had the necessary room now without any prejudice." End of quote. Ultimately, the monks, whose efforts were supported by German authorities but blocked by the UNRWA and IRO representatives, had to wait till the 12th of May in 1948 for the Jewish DPs to leave Sankt-Tilien for good. After their departure for the DP hospital Sonnenhof in Bad Wörishofen, probably not a coincidence that it was located close to the largest DP camp still existing at that time in Bavaria, the monks did not only gain access to all of their buildings, they were also able to file restitution claims for what had been lost and were finally, and for many more importantly, able to begin with the renovation and rebuilding of their home, schools, and missionary network that they had longed for many years. Conclude. While both Jewish DPs and Benedictine monks who spent the early post-war years at Sankt-Tilien might describe their post-war experiences as arduous journeys, it seems reasonable to assume that each individual's starting point, storyline, and destination would differ significantly. For the Jewish Holocaust survivors, their stay at the DP hospital was always intended to be a temporary one. After Hitler's war against the Jews, those who arrived in Sankt-Tilien were in desperate need of medical care and planned to move on to a new home outside of the German occupation zones as soon as possible. For the monks, arriving in Sankt-Tilien in 1945 marked the end to a period of displacement or the end of forced labor during which they had faced heavy persecution by the Nazi authorities. The clergy returned to state and waited desperately for what they claimed was rightfully theirs, access to all of the monastery. Diverse challenges call into question whether the new beginnings the members of each of these groups faced after the end of the war would be successful. As I've tried to show, a close examination of these distinct narratives, that is, of DPs and monks, offers fascinating insights regarding different policies and their competing efforts to mastering the post-war present and their attempts to shaping of the future. Yet, many questions remain, and I'm delighted that over the course of the next 2 days, we will have the opportunity to address some of them from both personal and scholarly perspectives. What, for example, do we know about the biographies of notable individuals like Sami Greenberg or Rabbi Avnon Klausner, who played leading roles in the setup of this camp and shared the beginnings of the DP hospital at Santo Tirin? What were specific health problems of the DPs at Santo Tirin, and what type of medical care was provided to them? What are central features of Santo Tirin's cultural, religious, and political life? Where did the Jewish DPs go once they left the DP hospital? And how did the lives of both the unaccompanied children cared for in Santo Tirin, as well as the lives of those born here, develop after Santo Tirin? And last but not least, how is Santo Tirin remembered? I'm convinced that only if bringing into dialogue the rich but often disparate histories of uprooted groups, we will begin to fully appreciate why, during the first three post-war years, Santo Tirin was a site of contestation, compromise, and confrontation. However, if discussed together, the narratives of monks and Jewish DPs will not only enable us to better demonstrate the dynamic interactions between different uprooted groups that live, either temporarily or long-term, in a society just emerging from 6 years of war and genocide. This approach will also allow us to highlight the complexities of shifting post-war settlements, and in doing so, to contribute to the ongoing efforts of writing a more inclusive refugee history that looks at the many different kinds of refugees and dislocated people in the same context. In 2018, a year in which we are confronted with new waves of refugees fleeing war and persecution, desperately searching for a place that can offer them shelter in the moment of emergency, this seems more important than ever.
Thank you very much, Andreas.
Overview of, and I think it fills